Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle 122 sub-episode Alpha. I'm Andy Zaltzman. You might remember me from previous editions of the Bugle, such as Bugle 34, Bugle 67, and last week's unforgettable Bugle 122. John and I are on our summer holiday, by which I mean John is on his summer holiday, and I am frantically hacking together my show for the Edinburgh Fringe, at which I hope and expect to see every single one of you at every single performance of my show, occurring daily from 6th to 29th of August, except the 16th, at 4:20pm at the stand. Tickets still available at the moment. In the meantime, to pass the next 4 weeks of full Bugle-less desolation, here is the official Bugle History of the World, 2007 to 2009, Part 1, October 2007 to June 2008. Nothing that happened before the Bugle came into existence is of much relevance to the world, given what has happened since. So we'll begin in November 2007 with one of the earliest known stories involving Hugo Chavez, the man who puts the way into Venezuela.
King Juan Carlos of Spain has told Hugo Chavez of Venezuela to shut up at a summit of Latin countries. I think Hugo is having another rant at fascists. He loves to rant. In many ways, he lives to rant. He's having a real go at the former Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar, and King Juan Carlos leant over and said to him, "Why don't you shut up?" Which is really international politics at its sparkling best.
Chavez, he really is something special. We should enjoy him while he's still around before he's bumped off by the CIA.
He is very much the Roger Federer of entertaining politicians. Chavez responded by saying, "Yes, the king is a head of state like me, only I've been elected three times with 63% support," and then moonwalked around the chamber.
I know it's hard to imagine it now, but back in late 2007, America was ruled by a deeply divisive president who split national opinion like a cheap banana. How times change. And in December 2007, that president, George W. Bush, the man who put the into United States of America, decided to use a rather retro means of communicating with his old axis of evil rival, North Korea.
Now, George W. Bush has been a busy man, not just claiming that Iran is a nuclear power, but he's been writing to North Korea on the subject of nuclear weapons as well, writing a letter. It's nice to keep in touch, so much more personal than the traditional email or televised trash-talking that Bush has generally favoured throughout his reign. Handwriting experts have suggested from the letter that Mr. Bush is confused and angry.
Now, the press have made a big deal of this, Andy, but in fact, Kim Jong-il and Bush are pen pals from a long time ago. They met at a summer camp when they were both children and kept in touch by regular letters. They never write about work, so neither one knows what the other one is up to at the moment. They just exchange recipes and say how they're feeling.
There's a great history of letters between major figures throughout history, dating back to the Battle of Hastings, when William the Conqueror sent King Harold a letter, but made the mistake of sending it attached to an arrow. It just had a circular joke on it. And it's believed that Harold's last words were, "Since when was my eye an intray?" There's other letters been dug up recently, this one from Hitler to Neville Chamberlain. "Dear Neville, still can't believe you fell for that. I'm feeling a little bit guilty, but only a little bit. Love, Adolf. P.S. Best wishes to Anne and the kids." This one is from the Duke of Wellington, and it reads, "Dear Napoleon, I'm going to take you down. I'm going to make you feel like a clown. Your cavalry got horses. They're going to need hearses. Your infantry couldn't march between February and April. Know what I mean? You rushed into Russia. Now have a brush with Prussia. Sincerely, Wellington."
A long time since there's been a Duke of Wellington joke, Andy. And I'll tell you why, because people say it isn't relevant anymore, and those people are crazy.
Well, you know, in many ways, Muhammad Ali modelled his pioneering trash-talking on the Duke of Wellington. And this letter from Florence Nightingale to William Gladstone. "Dear William, do I make you feel horny?"
Andy, love. Stop it. Stop it. This is becoming a running joke I want no part of. That woman did a lot of good.
You know, she did a lot of good, but, you know, she had a private side, and I'm not charging her for that.
Sleep well, Saltzman. Sleep well.
Of course, Bush would not remain in power forever. He was ousted a year later by a combination of constitutional inevitability and the Mexican secret police, so I've heard. And that process began in January 2008, as the long-awaited 2008 presidential election finally began. Only the second Bush-free presidential election since 1976, and the launch of the election campaign did not go unnoticed by the Bugle, or the American media, or most of the rest of the world.
Top story this week, and what could well become the highlight of the year, is the big race to the biggest prize in world politics is underway. By the end of 2008, America should have a 44th president. Although, let's not count our chickens just yet. The US election has begun. The Iowa caucus was recently completed, and it is estimated that each candidate will have spent around $200 per vote in Iowa, and by the end of the year, over $1 billion will have been spent manipulating the true will of the people. That is platinum democracy, Andy. America are about to get a lot of bang for their devalued buck.
So the race is on to become the 44th US president and also the winner of a commemorative silver salver. In the early running, Barack Obama and Mike Huckabee have been jointly elected presidents of Iowa. John, what signals does this give for the rest of the race? Perhaps you can just inform me and everyone else in Britain who literally doesn't understand how this ridiculous process works. What does this signify? Is there anyone in America who understands how it works as well? Because there are 302 days to go, as we broadcast on the 7th of January. 302 days to go until the election. That's yeah. 300. Now, if you mention the number 302 to most British people, like me, they'd probably say, well, that's West Indian stylist Lawrence Rowe's highest test match score. But
oh, for God's sake.
To other people, of course, 302 is... Well, it's the year that Gregory the Illuminator was consecrated as the Patriarch of Armenia.
I mean, it's interesting to think what that sentence would have been before the invention of the internet, Andy.
It would have been just a pause. I would have just been twiddling a pen. 302 days... And now, how can America stand 300 days of electioneering? And in Britain, we get 3 weeks, by which time the entire nation is standing on a high ledge screaming, someone, please just make the wittering stop.
Because America wants to enjoy its election, Andy. It's like a fine meal. You don't wolf it down in one go. You have a little bite of something, have a conversation, enjoy another little bite of something, and then have another course. Britain doesn't know how to do democracy, Andy.
John, that's a bit rich from someone who, on New Year's Eve, I saw a look at a steak tartare with a mixture of fear and apprehension as to what the future held and push it gently to the side of his plate.
Yeah, buglers should know that I went to Andy's house for New Year's Eve and Andy likes serving adventurous food. There are a couple of adventures too far for John Oliver there, steak tartare being amongst them. It just needs cooking.
Anyway, when it comes to culinary adventures, you're very much Captain Scott's friend who said, I'll tell you what, guys, I'm going to stay on the boat.
Who lived to tell the tale. But the caucus system is a little difficult to get your head around. Essentially, neighbours gather together in town halls and often people's houses and talk for an evening before voting on their candidate of choice. It's like selecting your leader with a tea party. And I'm amazed that hasn't caught on in Britain. What better representative sample of one of the most multicultural nations on earth than Iowa? The mood of the nation set by less than 300,000 white Protestant farmers. It's an up-close and personal form of politics, this, Andy. Candidates are forced to go to all corners of Iowa and New Hampshire and often go door-to-door campaigning. This really separates the men from the other men. How badly do you want to be president, Andy? Will you sit through some 73-year-old man's diatribe against Mexicans and how the moon landing was faked whilst pretending to like his wife's homemade corn muffins? Do you really want this job? Many have fallen at this stage. Roosevelt once proclaimed a homemade peach cobbler like eating a decaying pigeon before demonstrating exactly where the lady could stick her vote. That took a lot of coming back from.
Well, he came back from it, John, and that's the important thing, albeit he never walked again.
It has thrown up some big shocks, though, the Iowa caucus, and the breakthrough candidate in recent weeks has been Mike Huckabee, who has struck a chord with his progressive ideas, amongst them the fact that he doesn't believe in evolution, thinks people with AIDS should essentially be imprisoned, and has equated homosexuality with necrophilia.
Is Huckabee going to have the funds to go all the way, John? Because it does cost more, according to reports, to run a US election campaign than it would to send a life-size replica of Mexico to Saturn.
I believe that that's one of Tom Tancredo's promises, if elected. He's trying different formats in terms of gaining support. Like, he was joined on stage throughout the Iowa campaigning by Chuck Norris. Now, you might be thinking, oh, well, there must be another Chuck Norris, maybe a professor of politics somewhere or a lesser-known senator. There's no way he'd take a kung fu star on stage with him in a presidential primary. Well, I'm afraid you're wrong. It's that Chuck Norris from Way of the Dragon and Silent Rage, him.
I hear he is being lined up for a post as the Secretary of State, should Huckabee win.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he might just pack a bit more punch than Condoleezza Rice.
Well, really? That is spoken like a true man who has never seen Condoleezza Rice punch a wall.
Looking back through the icy prism of history, we now know that early in 2008, the world's economy was about to go downhill so fast that Swiss ski fans would soon be banging cowbells at it as it sped past them. And there were already some early signs that it might prove to have been a bit of a blooper to have left the entire financial stability of the world in the hands of certifiable pigs.
So, our top story this week, money, 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 money!
Are you still there, John? Are you all right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, oh, I'm here. Right. I'm here. Sorry, Rick James came in for a second and just decided to lay down a fat track. His stay was brief, but funky. So, is the world on the brink of an economic meltdown? Now, in the interest of disclosure, let me point out that I know absolutely nothing about economics. I've lived for 30 years on this planet, two elsewhere, and I still don't get it. To me, economics is like the Dutch language. I'm told it makes sense, but I seriously have my doubts. Now, the US Federal Reserve slashed interest rates to 3.5%, the biggest rate cut in 25 years, and incredibly, the markets have staged a comeback for the time being for reasons that no one understands and that no one can explain. Now, so they lost billions of dollars through wild speculation and in response are giving $600 to each US citizen in tax breaks. And that respectful gesture will be most appropriately delivered by posting 60 $10 bills into the top of the underwear of each American citizen, muttering, "There you go, sweet cheeks, buy yourself something pretty and shut up."
Which I believe Mike Huckabee is suggesting in his election manifesto.
Yep, to great acclaim.
But across the globe, more than $5 trillion has disappeared from the value of public companies in the first 3 weeks. I'm no financial expert, John, but $5 trillion, that's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money, yeah, you could...
Even given the exchange rate, that's still over £1 million. There you go. Well, it's over the rope.
Brokers want free market economics, no regulation and no government interference, unless that government interference is bailing their behinds out of trouble, in which case they want plenty of interference, sweet, protective interference. Then they'd like to be left alone again to plunder the developing world before once again overstepping the mark and coming back to suck on the teat of the Fed.
The Fed, of course, has slashed interest rates. Now, it's been under huge pressure, the Fed, which might explain its below-par performance in the Australian Open. There's a joke for tennis fans.
And only a selection of tennis fans. The old economic saying is, when the US sneezes, the world catches a cold. Well, the US seems to have sneezed so hard, its economic balls have fallen off. And now the world is looking down at its own balls, saying, please don't leave me.
I don't really understand a number of aspects of global economics. America is the world's leading capitalist economy. Also, famously, big fan of Jesus, America.
Yeah.
Who, of course, said it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. So it seems slightly odd that such a wealthy nation should be so Christian. But I guess what they could say is that by perpetuating global poverty, they're merely helping the world's poor get through heaven's notoriously restrictive immigration policy.
That is a positive I've not heard anyone use yet, but I imagine that will come quickly now. And this may be playing into hands of candidate Mitt Romney, more of whom later, the multimillionaire. People in the US might feel they trust someone who's been successful in business to revive the economy if he does become president. Head for the hills. But in many ways, the world economy is already in recession. The question is, will the recession be long and shallow, like an Olympic-sized paddling pool, or short and deep, like Danny DeVito?
Can you just explain that last comment?
Well, he's short and he's a very thoughtful man. He's a fan of Camus. Also this week, the World Economic Forum was held in Davos, Switzerland, and it was a chance for the heads of the world's leading companies to gather together, cackle like demons, roll around on beds of money, and maybe try a bit of snowboarding. According to the WEF's motto, it is committed to improving the state of the world. Although, that is from a logo of businessman who is laughing as he says it. Now, was Bono there? Of course Bono was there. And as it was going on, Bush called for a kickstart for the economy in a speech. And as soon as he finished the speech, the Nasdaq plunged 300 points. That is not a great vote of confidence in someone. That's a tough response, Andy. I've had bad gigs. I know you have, Andy. But have you ever had a gig so bad that the world nosedived towards economic Armageddon?
I did do this one gig at the Comedy Store in Manchester, where at best I struggled. And at worst, I abominated. After that, it was tough times across Europe as shares plunged and businessmen just generally looked out of high office windows and thought, should I?
This crisis began when US mortgage companies made hundreds of billions of dollars of inappropriate loans to individuals with poor credit histories. And these debts were then somehow packaged up and sold on to financial institutions around the world, who then sold it on to pension funds and hedge funds. So we still don't know where these bad debts are and where they are concealed in the financial system. These debts have essentially run away from home, Andy. We need to put pictures of the debts on milk cartons, or have world leaders hold a tearful press conference to plead with the debts to come on home. That they love them. They're not angry, they just want to know they're safe.
But there was no time to worry about the economy falling to pieces like a recently dumped teenage jigsaw, because Tuesday was coming, and not just any Tuesday, Super Tuesday.
24 states are set to have primary elections on this Super Tuesday. Some news networks have chosen to use different words, such as Monster Tuesday, or perhaps most crassly, Bill Schneider on CNN, who referred to it as Tsunami Tuesday, which presumably comes straight after Genocide Monday, and just before Plague Wednesday.
Was there some kind of breakdown between brain and mouth there?
Actually, no, that connection has never been there for Schneider. But it's a democratic frenzy in the US, Andy, as America goes to the ballot box to elect the person they want the option of choosing to elect leader of the free world. It's electing a choice. Record turnouts in many states are predicted, so it seems the idea of democracy rather than reality is most appealing. There's every chance that this turnout is going to be bigger than the one for the real election. People like going just up to the point of being actively involved in the democratic process and then dodging out at the last minute.
Is there not a danger, though, that if Super Tuesday proves decisive in both races, that the candidates will be left with February to November in which to sling mud at each other, and they could run out of mud to sling by mid-July and be reduced to just the odd little barbed comment or double-edged compliment?
You are vastly underestimating the mud-making ability of the United States political system. There have been some high-profile exits from the campaign already. Rudy Giuliani, the self-styled Sultan of 9/11, has abandoned his challenge for the White House after a spectacular implosion. He was leading in virtually all the polls before the race properly began, but then he began opening his mouth and saying words, and that quickly became a problem.
I mean, he has made certain tactical errors, Giuliani. For example, being massively unpopular, not actually joining in the election at all, treating the voters with total contempt, and just hoping there'd be enough to swan in halfway through and bleat on about how he personally crushed Al-Qaeda. He was basically seen one step away from coming out and saying, you know what, I actually enjoyed 9/11. If I had the chance, I'd do it all again.
That's the thing, people have suddenly remembered, upon words spewing out of his mouth, what an odious man he actually is. And I don't know what the Republican base did not like about the three-marriage pro-abortion Giuliani. He actually would have done better saying nothing, literally nothing. He could have been America's first mime president, refusing to say anything to annoy people, communicating only through semaphore or charades.
Charades? You've been in America too long, John. Charades, John.
How do you pronounce it? Charades. No, oh, I love that accent.
In the home of the English language.
Oh, it's quaint.
It's interesting statistically, actually, that Giuliani was the only candidate who had been played by James Woods in a biopic. Which suggests that America won't vote for someone who's been played by James Woods in a biopic.
Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, science probably backs that up. In fact, it's scientifically impossible that Giuliani could have run a worse campaign. Scientists have been conducting experiments to see if it is possible, and they've been working through the night, but could only stumble bleary-eyed into the sunlight this morning, peering disbelievingly at a graph, saying, I don't know how he did it. This shouldn't be technically possible.
Well, I disagree, John. I think there were a number of things Giuliani could have done worse, albeit that this is now almost universally viewed as the worst ever election campaign. He could have run his entire campaign from a diving bell at the bottom of Lake Michigan, communicating with the nation only by means of messages fed to fish.
That would have been better.
Okay, he could have promised to give all the territory from the Louisiana Purchase back to the French in exchange for a bottle of Grolsch and a go on President Sarkozy's new girlfriend.
That would have been worse.
Right, he could have campaigned in California on a restart all the bushfires ticket.
Don't know about that. The rest of America probably would have gone with that.
He could have said to John McCain, well, if they kept you in that prison camp for so long, maybe it was something about you, not something about them. And he could have done a nationwide TV advertisement in which he mumbled incoherently about table tennis for a couple of minutes, then sang I Will Survive in Russian, urinated on the American flag, and threatened to execute a hostage live unless his demand to be president was met within 20 minutes. I went on the internet last night, John, and found that you can still donate money to the Giuliani presidential campaign. Now, I wanted to, I really did, but I'm not eligible because I'm not a US resident, and the last thing Rudy needs at a time like this is to be embroiled in a funding row. But I would like to think that Giuliani's website will be left exactly as it is, with no reference to him pulling out of the race, kind of like an online Pompeii, preserving this moment of volcanic self-combustion for eternity.
John Edwards also dropped out recently amidst rumours of him becoming a kingmaker for either Clinton or Obama, but he has so far refused to endorse either. He ran his campaign on an anti-poverty message, and the US never really connected with that. It turns out people here support poverty, Andy, and they're right. We need poverty as much as poverty needs us. Otherwise, how do we know how good our houses are? It's also boom time for celebrity endorsements here. We talked a couple of weeks ago about Mike Huckabee's inexplicable endorsement by Chuck Norris. It's hard to know what was more confusing about that pairing, that Huckabee would choose a faded kung fu star, or that a faded kung fu star would choose a man who doesn't believe in evolution. One thing's for sure, they made quite a pairing. They deserved each other. But the mystifying endorsements did continue this week. Sylvester Stallone came out for John McCain, and just a few days ago, Barack Obama was endorsed by Hulk Hogan.
Super Tuesday there, and more from Super Tuesday on Tuesday 2012. Back now to March 2008. Now, Britain is no stranger to being invaded by the French. It didn't go so well for us back in 1066 when Big William the Conqueror tucked us up like a kipper and turned our king into a kebab. But in 2008, Britain was a little bit more excited about a modern-day French leader pitching up on our shores. Why? For the simple reason that Mrs. Sarkozy was better looking than Mrs. the Conqueror had been all those years before. Although I'm not sure the Bayeux Tapestry really showed her at her sizzling best.
The French president's wife has visited Britain and she is hot. That is the news this week. We don't yet know whether the French president also came or what he was here for, but his wife was here.
It's not important.
And she's pretty.
She is very pretty. Hot off the press. Both the story and his wife. I can't even remember his name. And I can't remember hers either, but she's hot. Britain has been in a real tiz this week over the state visit of President Sarkozy of France, the first state visit by a French president for 12 years. And he's been attempting to seduce the House of Commons with his smooth mentions of gratitude for the Second World War and lascivious invitations to bond deeper with the EU, all with his come-to-Brussels eyes. He said that instead of the Entente Cordiale, we should now have an Entente Amicale. And Prime Minister Gordon Brown said he thought it should in fact be an Entente Formidable. See, we can't even agree on how to describe this new good relationship. It's never going to work, Andy. Let's just go back to firing arrows at each other. We were good at that.
Well, in fact, I mean, the whole relationship between Britain and France has been a bit sticky ever since that old Battle of Hastings, King Harold, hey, watch this, I'm going to catch this one in my teeth. Squelch, ow, that hurt, oops. I can only see in two dimensions now. Youch. Yup, with hindsight, that was a bit cocky. Well, I was playing to the embroiderers. Still, no complaints. The Normans have been the better team on the day, and William's a top-class conqueror. There's no shame in losing what's been a terrific battle for the neutrals incident.
First ever post-battle interview, though. When asked if this newfound closeness between Britain and France would last, Sarkozy stated, "This is more than a one-night stand. We will go into the next day for breakfast." Stop it, you Gallic Lothario! Not everything has to be about sex! This is international relations, Caligula, not the last days of Rome.
And more importantly, this is Britain.
This is Britain.
Keep it in your trousers. It's amazing, though, the incredibly juvenile reaction of Britain as a nation, in particular the British press, to this visit. We basically completely ignore politics until a hot woman becomes involved, yep. And then all of a sudden, it's front page news. As you say, first visit by a French president for 12 years. Yeah. But also, more importantly, it's the first time that a head of state has come to Britain bringing a wife who's banged Mick Jagger, as far as we know.
Is that true?
Well, Raisa Gorbachev was once heard humming the tune to Gimme Shelter whilst talking about boys with Mrs. Thatcher, but that could have been coincidence. We don't know.
Sarkozy did say that he's been deeply moved by the positive reception of his wife by the British press, saying, "I'm proud that people have seen her for what she is and that there is a sense of justice." And this is the same British press who had days before printed nude photos of his wife. Of course they love her. They love anyone who they have nude photos of. If Ava Brown had done a centrefold spread, I'd be speaking to you in German now. Sarkozy has received a great deal of criticism in France for, amongst other things, his love of Rolex watches and the fact that upon being elected he chose to marry a supermodel and start jetting around the world. He seems to have mistaken being president with being a racing driver. The Daily Mail wrote of Carla Bruni that not since Anne Boleyn has a woman curtsied so deeply, so demurely, or so calculatedly before a British monarch. Well, that's as maybe, but let's remember what happened after Anne Boleyn curtsied. She was beheaded.
Mr. Sarkozy, interestingly, is only 1.65 metres long when lying on the floor without his shoes on. He's a big Law and Order fan and likes nothing more than trying to Americanise the French economy whilst getting married for the third time. He's promised France will never forget what Britain did for it in the World Wars. And the feeling is extremely mutual. Britain won't forget it either. In fact, if anything, we're likely to carp on about it for just a little too long. And Sarkozy also said that Britain is a political and human ideal. A comment so outlandishly complimentary as to make Britain's youth take a moment's break from vomiting all over itself to look at him in surprise and reply, "Now, mate, you are on the wrong train. The wrong train, comprende?"
Food, inglorious food. We all eat it, unless we're starving to death in a world food crisis, which is exactly what was happening in April 2008, and some people were not too happy about it.
Peckish? Well, statistically, you probably are. The head of the UN World Food Programme this week described the current global food shortages as a silent tsunami which knows no borders sweeping the world. That is a beautifully articulated and deeply depressing point, but I'm afraid it's not true, for this tsunami is a clear respecter of borders, proven by the fact that whilst countries around the developing world are rioting in the streets in the face of malnutrition and hunger, we've only recently started to pay attention because pizza's just got a bit more expensive.
Food could actually soon be a thing of the past. In Britain, the family food shop has gone up £15 a week on average. And let's not forget, John, here in Britain, we don't get tasty tidbits airdropped on us like the starving Africans do.
That's true. And yet you don't see journalists reporting about that, do you?
No, you don't.
Cost has gone up 40% worldwide since mid-2007, and there have been these riots and protests in Cameroon, Burkina Faso, Haiti, Egypt, many other countries that the West would love to care about, but just can't. We've got a lot on our mind at the moment. We'll get round to it. The neediness is a real turn-off, though.
Yeah.
Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, also issued warnings about the current expansion of biofuels, which convert cereals into fuel. And could this be the biggest f*** you yet to the developing world? Not only have we gorged ourselves to morbidly obese levels, now we are burning food as well. Ethanol production is on course to account for some 30% of the US maize crop by 2010, dramatically curtailing the amount of land available for food crops. We would rather have fuel than food. People will go to restaurants in the future to have their meal set on fire in front of them. Then they'll just sit back with a napkin in their lap, watch it burn, pronounce it delicious, tip the waiter and leave.
I mean, I don't understand why this is a problem, John. You would have thought that, you know, in an era where the world population is soaring upwards and, you know, the pressure on global food production is increasing, that using a large chunk of the world's agricultural lands to make stuff for our cars, you'd thought that would be fine.
But, yeah, what's wrong with that?
You know, the bottom line is someone has got the maths wrong. My theory is, though, that the world's poor, as always, are copping it right in the nadgers. But they must have developed an immunity to it by now.
Surely. I mean, we spent the last 2,500 years lining them up against the wall, running straight at them and thwacking them in the plums with a cricket bat. Surely they can barely even feel anything now. These people don't need food. They don't need food. And if we can just starve off the excess 30% who use a disproportionate 1% of the food and energy of the world, then, you know, no one would have a problem. Is that wrong?
We might need a running translation for any American listeners there as to what nadgers and plums refer to, although, to be honest, I think you can probably guess. The truth is, Andy, it's like the old saying goes, you reap what you sow. And when you sow the seeds of global inequality, don't act surprised with what sprouts up come harvest time.
Also, John, I don't see why it should always be us in the West that has to change our behaviour. Why should it be us that has to use these renewable energies instead of food-based car fuel? Why can't the poor people of the world learn to eat the wind and the sun? That's not unreasonable.
Now, I don't know about you, but I, for one, do not like terrorists. And neither did the American legal system in June 2008. So it farmed one of the world's naughtiest terrorists off to a military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the number 3 ranked baddie in the whole of Al-Qaeda. Which I think means he was seeded to play bin Laden in the semi-final, although I believe it's been postponed for a while.
Bugle law news now, and the law very much in inverted commas. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the number 3 ranked terrorist in Al-Qaeda, and 4 of his henchmen are appearing before a military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay.
Shouldn't you technically call him the bronze medal terrorist for that?
Yeah, he's bronze medal. I guess, you know, if you're having a terrorism Davis Cup tie, you probably wouldn't have him in the singles, but you might have him playing doubles with bin Laden. Or maybe if it was a dead rubber, he might get one of the 3-set singles on day 3.
That's right. Last week was the opening day at Guantanamo Bay of the trial of the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks on the US. So I say trial. It is, in fact, a military tribunal, just to put America in an even more controversial situation. They just live for controversy at the moment, Andy. They're like early 90s Madonna.
Of course, a lot of people are saying that that he won't get a fair trial, and America's response to this is, well, he should have thought of that before he did his terror. Proving both sides' points, I guess.
The man in question, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, has dismissed the trial as an inquisition and is demanding to represent himself in court. He said that he had 5 years under torture and wished to become a martyr, and it seems as though America is about to oblige. And, Andy, if you're an Al-Qaeda leader, and I'm not saying you are, although I'm not saying you're not either, I merely don't have enough information either way at this time. If you are, though, then you've got almost everything on your wish list of hate to Santa since September the 10th, 2001. You pulled off an improbable and brutal attack which provoked your victim to lash out wildly at anyone with an owl anywhere near their name, turning genuine sympathy into resentment, then outright hostility, adding to the mix an illegal war fostering even more resentment, and then the cherry on the cake being that if you need someone to bump you off into the eternal paradise that you inexplicably think you deserve, then once again, just rub the great Satan up the wrong way, and like a myopic genie, your wish will be granted.
Khalid, can we call him Khalid, or is that a bit over-familiar? I'm going to call him KSM.
He sounds like a Dutch airline.
He said these exact words, I'm looking to be martyr for a long time, perhaps suggesting that he learnt his English from a Thai prostitute, which, you know, is, I don't know if that's going to be relevant to the trial. But it's interesting that KSM and the USA, for once, are actually very much singing off the same hymn sheet. And hymn number one in this case is Bring on the Death Penalty. Words by D. Rumsfeld, music by Hubert Parry, 1918, to the tune of Jerusalem.
Surely, Andy, anything he wants to do, you should do the opposite. This man is a power tool. No, because he went on to shout at the end of this little speech, God is great, God is great, God is great. Now, if God does reward, Andy, those who perpetrate mindless acts of mass violence, I will happily not go to heaven because I don't want to spend eternity having awkward conversations with an arsehole. Again, that's a big if God does reward that, if.
KSM has undergone the US hobby of waterboarding. Simulated drowning, which seems to be going on quite a lot, so much so that some inmates have apparently evolved gills as a defence mechanism. But cleverly, they did this not in Guantanamo Bay, so in legal terms, it's fine as long as the prosecuting lawyer looks sideways at the judge and taps the side of his nose when introducing the evidence. So it will be okay.
The problem is how fair a trial can actually be when the prosecution openly admits using waterboarding and other dishes of torture tapas. I mean, try that in front of Judge Judy, she'll laugh you out of the courtroom. It's thought that the prosecution are going to try and re-obtain the information they're going through waterboarding with so-called clean questioning. Even that sounds a little sinister. I mean, maybe they'll just try the old, I remember that thing you said to us when you thought you were drowning. What was that again? And if he says it, then boom, that has got to be admissible. He said the exact same words in a non-precipice of death scenario. Bang to rights, bucko.
Also, the little notice 28th Amendment that the Bush regime has hurried through could be crucial. That amendment being that out of sight, out of mind is now legally binding, as is what Geneva doesn't know won't hurt it. Also, the trials are taking place in Camp Justice in Guantanamo, which does sound rather like a new primetime TV show in which Graham Norton presides over retrials in a special spangly court at the Old Bailey.
Actually, Andy, the key thing there, it's like with Japanese, the key thing is the inflection. It's actually Camp Justice. There's a question mark at the end of it.
But we can't complain, John. We can't complain about the way America is conducting these trials because, let's not forget, they invented the war on terror, so they can make the rules. It's very much like when we in Britain invented cricket. You know, no one can claim that the LBW law is objectively morally right, but because we invented the great game and we didn't want people putting their legs in the way of the wickets, we invented the LBW law. It would be the highest cantaloupe on the melon shelf of hypocrisy to demand that America backs down on this.
But what is KSM's problem, Andy? The US has pledged that he will receive a fair trial. And they don't just pledge anything, you know. When these people pledge something, it stays pledged. No joke. If they pledge they'll get you a cup of coffee, you know you have a cup of hot, hot bean coming your way. US Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that Washington is stuck with Guantanamo, whether people want to close it or not. This administration has effectively given this country a deeply regrettable tattoo to remember them by, and it's going to take a long time and be extremely expensive to erase that tattoo. Of the 270 or so prisoners there, Gates claims around 50 to 70 of them were an irreducible minimum, but against whom it would be very difficult to bring charges due to either not enough or no evidence. Terrific selling job, Willie Loman. I'll take it. There is a group which are seen as being too dangerous to release, but whom no case can be brought. And this seems to suggest that when they were brought into Guantanamo, they were innocent, but they've now been treated so badly that they are fully qualified terrorists with a violent grudge against the West. In other words, they've managed to create their very own terrorist camp. And now they know the location of one of the most effective producers of Islamic terrorists, they have absolutely no option but to order airstrikes against themselves.
I'm sick of evidence, though, John. It just really clogs up the legal system. It must be so dull for judges. You know, another bit of evidence. Oh, let me guess. Is it another exhibit? What a surprise. Please do show it to the jury. I'm sure they're absolutely busting to see it.
So there you go. That concludes the first of the four instalments of the official Bugle History of the World, 2007 to 2009. More next week when we look at 2008, the second bit. Could Barack Obama see off the twin challenge of Rudy Giuliani and Mike Gravel to win America? Tune in next week to find out. Or look it up on the internet if you can't wait until then. And don't forget to book your tickets for my Edinburgh show. It would just be such a shame if you came all the way to Scotland, only to find that all the other 7 billion potential buglers in the world had booked for the same day. And you can keep up to date with what's not happening in the world while we're away on the Bugle Twitter feed, at Hello Buglers. Until next week, bye-bye from both me, Andy Zaltzman, and me, Andy Zaltzman, PP John Oliver.